Good evening. The title of tonight's talk is Making Time. Making Time. I wonder if you're thinking what I am. This is our last retreat, and it's time for an inspirational pep talk about how you should carve an hour out of your daily schedule for sitting meditation or sun salutes. You know, along the lines of enlightenment, only 1 hour a day. Okay. So I hope it isn't disappointing if I talk a little bit more tonight along the lines of what we were talking about yesterday morning, about the mind, about the nature of mind. You know, mainly about how there's really no such thing as mind. That's right. I'm going to say that there's really no such thing as the mind. Instead, I thought it'd be more illuminating, actually mind-blowing, to really look into this thing, or non-thing, and see if it's anything more than its various processes. In Indian thought, we could actually use, instead of processes, we could say karma, actions, things that are being done, that leave a consequence. So let's investigate the karma of the mind, of mentality, how it adds to, how it puts things together, how it arranges them, connects them into new structures, things that actually don't exist in nature, apart from the mind, in here, you know. I think they exist in the mind as a kind of shelter from the unpredictable weather of the world. So I want to explore for a little bit of our time together what conditions produce these structures, how much energy is needed to put things together. I want to investigate the forces that cause them to eventually come apart. Oh wait, I just remembered a joke. The mind is like that. Okay, dinner, Frank Jude Boccio told me this. So dukkha, anicca, and anatta walk into a bar. Dukkha looks around and says, "This sucks." Anicca says, "Don't worry, it'll pass." And anatta says, "You talking to me?" Good. I really have no idea what that has to do with what I'm going to talk about. Right? Talk to me? Actually, I'd like to tell you about myself just a little bit. When I was a young man of 18, I lived and played as a drummer in a jazz quintet. I was also a pianist. But I was living on Martha's Vineyard Island playing with this band, and we weren't very good. We had a lot of trouble finding work, so I managed to snag a summer job. I was going to help a builder on Martha's Vineyard Island where we lived. I had very little experience. I could barely pound a nail. This was in the days before nail guns. And I remember feeling perhaps the strongest feeling of dread I have ever felt, except for before tonight's Dharma talk. When I arrived at the new job site, which was on his property in the edge of town, he'd marked off a large rectangle of dirt. Looked like his whole property was just dirt and weeds. There was an empty lot. There were stakes and string and little plastic flags. And while he completed another job elsewhere, I was going to be by myself, entrusted to digging a trench around the perimeter of this marked off area. And then after the trench had been poured with concrete, I was to build a foundation all the way around. Three cinder blocks high. I was to do this masonry by myself, even composing the mortar by hand in a little antiquated rusty mixer they had that had to be hand cranked. But I had never laid a brick or a block in my entire brief life. And then, presuming that I might actually finish this task, he and I would go on to build a frame on top of this foundation and then put a small house there. Okay? The thing is, he was building it for his 90-year-old parents. I remember thinking that I was way out of my depth and that the foundation would probably collapse and the house would cave in on these dear souls. I actually wondered if it would be simpler just to dig their graves now. But there was something else that made an impression on me, too. He had already assembled all the materials they were laying about there. There were pallets covered with cinder blocks, for example, my nemesis, and bags of dry mortar. Stacks of lumber, 2x4s, plywood, 4x8s, shingles, roof tiles. He took me to a shed. There were these covered buckets of nails looking at me with their claws. I remember actually glancing at a shovel that was leaning up in the shed, and suddenly I realized it was meant for me. I felt like Scrooge. Remember when he's led to the cemetery by the ghost of Christmas yet to come, and he points to a tombstone with his name on it? See, I knew that that shovel was going to rough up my tender hands, my back and shoulders straining under all those cinder blocks and stuff. There'd be splinters, smashed fingertips, bruised shins. Even worse, the frustration of not knowing what the hell I was doing. And getting things wrong and having to take them apart and put them right. This was going to be a lot of work, a lot of energy. I had never understood that about a house before. You know, when I was born, the house that I grew up in had already been built. Yeah. It's not like I was born out in the ground and then they built it around me. So I'd always taken houses for granted and looked at them, and I knew that they were slapped together by carpenters and masons and glaziers and so forth. But I didn't understand all of the energy that goes into assembling the parts and putting them together, and even after all that work, that they might fall apart. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that house for now. But I promise to tell you what happened to it. And to his elderly parents. At the end of the talk, okay? So don't fall asleep. All right. It may seem kind of random for me to talk about this, but I really want to explore how things are put together, because I think that the teachings and the practice of yoga and Dharma, the teachings of Patanjali and the Buddha, awaken us to the possibility that we too are assembled, constructed, fabricated. That's an interesting word, fabricate. Usually when we say it, we mean lie. And maybe if we think we're permanent, but we're actually put together, it is a kind of a lie in which we live. Okay? Now with this knowledge, and we're talking about direct knowledge, not just book learning, we might be able to practice the art of stepping outside once in a while. Not that we necessarily want to live out there, but to be able to step out from under the roof of the self and know the vastness and freedom of the sky, of space. You know, for Siddhartha Gautama, the future Buddha, meditating alone in the wilderness, the only roof over his head for many years was just a few branches of tree, and then beyond that, the starry sky. After the Buddha, after Gautama had abandoned the path of mortifying himself, sitting in a cave and doing all kinds of tough things to himself, and resumed meditating, becoming absorbed in the energies of the body and the breath, some of the same practices that you were doing here in the past few days, he awakened. And one of his insights was that this was the middle way. It was an approach somewhere between austerity and sensual indulgence. I think by today's standards, though, the middle way is still pretty austere. You know, he remained a wandering monk. He was homeless for the rest of his life. He also dropped his clan name, his identity. He preferred the title Tathagata. Tathagata, tata, and gata. You could translate that, I guess, as gone to thusness, or arrived at what is. Okay? Which we might just say, nobody's home. So I think it's really fitting, kind of not surprising, that when he awakened under the Bodhi tree near Gaya, tradition has it that he uttered this famous verse, which you've heard before, but I think it's always good to hear. It's recorded in the work called Dhammapada. House builder, now that you've been glimpsed, you shall not raise this house again. Your rafters all are broken, your ridgepole shattered. The mind is free of fabricated things and come to the end of suffering. I'll say that again. House builder, now that you've been glimpsed, you shall not raise this house again. Your rafters all are broken, your ridgepole shattered. The mind is free of fabricated things and come to the end of craving. I still get that same feeling I had the first time I heard this teaching, because I heard it in a Dharma talk at Barry. And it gave me an immense feeling of rest, of relief, to slough off all that efforting, all that wanting and resistance to what is. But I think within a moment of hearing it, another thought arose in me, which was that house builder is certainly working overtime in me, making me. It's as if all the wants and the needs, the unfinished business of oneself are never done. They never can be done. Each new day brings new experiences that are added onto the storyline, the narrative, where they're adjusting it, stretching out to imagine future. Maybe that's happened to you. You're kind of like, okay, 6 days to go, and then I'll have another retreat under my belt. Ah, what then for my life? You know, this sense of, ah, my life. Yesterday morning I was speaking a little bit about what Patanjali, also the Buddha, call the pollutants, corruptions, kleshas, causes of suffering in the Yoga Sutra, among them desire, craving, and aversion, not liking, and how these are residues, they're traces of past experience. But I want to clarify that a little bit for you. To say that they're traces of past experience is not exactly the whole story. They're more than just a recollection of an experience. They include something extra. The feeling of liking and not liking that arose right on the heel of an experience, like tasting the soup tonight. Liking. Okay? And then maybe craving on the heels of the liking. And perhaps a sense of clinging, a contracting around something. By the way, you'll also remember that Patanjali saw the feeling of being a self. Remember we call that I am-ness in Sanskrit? Asmi, which means I am, and ta means nas. So I am-ness, asmita, as being a product of a maker of me, aham, me, I, kara, ahamkara. The eye maker. So it really sounds to me kind of like the house builder. And this is obviously an old yogic idea. Something is constructing this me. And if it doesn't actually stay there by itself, this me, but needs to be cobbled together. How could that me possibly ever be satisfied, protected? Its very nature is unstable, unfillable. I believe that there was a wealthy widow, maybe who lived here in California. Cry out if you know who I'm talking about, or if you lived with her. She had this enormous mansion, this is what I'm saying. And her husband died, she had a tremendous amount of money, and she believed fervently that as long as she had a carpenter there working on an addition, building extra rooms in the house.
Winchester
what? Okay, and that's in what state? Okay, I knew it. I knew it was California. The reason why I'm not sure is because I didn't have my source, which is this old 1934 copy of Ripley's Believe It or Not that my father had as a kid. He was 9 years old. So I presume that she's no longer alive. I'm not sure whether the carpenter called in sick or whether it's just that all the construction in the world won't stop change. I want to go back to yesterday morning. I mentioned some of the materials, the mental materials that come together to form what feels like me and the world. And last night, Philip also touched on them. But if you're like me, it might help you to hear them a few more times. Actually, in my case, a few hundred times to really get them to sink in. I'm talking about things like the khandhas, the aggregates, which I'll describe. I don't want to get too technical, but whenever you start me talking, there's a danger of that. And I apologize for the dry language. But again, this reminds me of that house that I was working on. Because they're basically two types of stuff that make up our experience. And it's the same way with a house. In a house, all that stuff that was laid out for me that I was dreading, well, that was one type, all the kind of solid materials, if you will. The other stuff that makes up the house consists of the idea about it, the blueprints, the work orders, and the actual execution of it, all that efforting, okay? Both of these combine to make a house. But back to our experience. In the Indian tradition, there are two basic components to experience. Okay, there's all the stuff that's coming in through our five senses, which are called form. Form, Sanskrit, rupa, Pali, to rupa. Okay, I know you know that word. And then there's mentality, which is called nama. And I know you've heard that too. So nama rupa, nama rupa. And sometimes these are translated as mentality and physicality. That's fine. But I want to caution you just a little bit about that. In the sense that the Buddha or Patanjali uses it, rupa refers not to some ontological existence. By that I mean something that really exists in the world necessarily, but rather to an appearance. Rupa refers to an appearance. In everyday language, in fact, it just means something you see, like a visible form. Okay? Something you see with the eye. Okay? But that doesn't necessarily mean matter. Okay? Under a certain circumstance, you could be seeing Julia Roberts walk along, but she's not really there materially. It's just flickering light on a screen because you're at the movies. Okay? So it's a form, but that's not the same thing as saying that it's matter. It's something hard that exists, persists, has some kind of essence, whatever that is. I mean, in contemporary physics, there's no essence anyway, right? Even a diamond, the hardest substance. What is it? Well, it's just space with some carbon atoms. Oh, they're something, right? Well, no, the atoms turn out to be mostly empty space, somehow bounded by energetic vibration. By these kind of piano strings that aren't even strings, they're just vibration in the string without the string. You could save so much money playing the piano if you could do that, you know? So, in other words, there's really nothing at the core of anything except these kinds of relationships of energy. Oddly enough, both Patanjali and the Buddha seem to have sensed something like this. Not the details of quantum physics or anything, although you'll hear people claim that. But the kind of gist of the idea. All right? The Buddha in particular was very firm in refusing to define anything in the world itself, as objectively real or unreal. I think you've heard this famous teaching. When the Deva, Rohatasa, visits him, the Buddha says, it is in just this fathom-long carcass, endowed with mind and perception, that I describe the world, its arising, its cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. It is just in this fathom-long carcass, endowed with mind and perception. So it's not just me or you that might be put together, but also this world through which we appear to be moving. And I want you to notice that the Buddha's word for mind is the same as Patanjali's here, manas, manas. It's a word that we were talking about a little bit yesterday as coordinating the inputs streaming in of, and when we take the reins of manas and direct it here and not there, we begin to control our attention, and we call that attention. But as I said to you, attention isn't really a thing. It's turning to this, turning to that, staying with this, staying with that. So this world, including you and me, by the way, consists of turning toward what's coming in through all the six senses. Now, that doesn't shock you anymore that I just said that, right? The six senses. Everybody knows what those are, what I'm referring to. They're the usual five. But what's the sixth? Yeah, right. It's mental consciousness, knowing mental objects, right? So in Indian understanding, that too is a kind of a sense, if you will. Nama. Okay. Now, what are these? Well, Philip mentioned them last night. I mentioned them in the morning. But again, you could hear them morning and night for a week or two, maybe a month or two, and they might just start to sink in, right? So it's fine, I think, to go over them one more time. Okay. We talked about forms, of course, but here we're talking about the mentality. And there's that, first of all, that bare sense of liking or not liking or neither that can arise, conditioned from an experience. Okay? And you've been working with that, beginning to become sensitive to that. And I'll talk about how that happens and why in that order in just a little bit. Huh? Now, you've heard this called feeling tone or vedna, vedna. Feeling tone is actually a good translation of it because the word ved, it's associated with feeling, experiencing. And the na, it's kind of like the feelness of it. Okay, so, but it would sound pretty weird to say feelness, so feeling tone. So an example would be tasting that soup tonight. You know, you taste it and, so you get the idea. All right. But there's another kind of mental event that occurs too, and that I would call apperception. Not just perception, but apperception, in the sense that we're adding on to a percept. The Indian word actually says it a lot better. This is yesterday morning. That's samnya. Nya means knowing, knowing, awareing. And sam means with, like the Greek sin, S-Y-N. So samnya, samnya, or Pali, samnya. This is a kind of an extra knowing that goes with the knowing. A recognition, a label, a caption, a bubble, a sidebar. It's a mental act of linking this to that. And what we're linking, a conceptual link, a concept is linked to maybe sight, blue, sky, okay? Those are samnya, right? Or it might be linked to a mental, or a sensation in the heart, sad. But that's knowing with, samnya, okay? A name tag. So, walking in the line tonight at dinner, And seeing that, going, soup. Okay, that would be an example of some, yeah, and there are many different kinds, I guess, too. So it's tying in experience to us. But again, it's an act of joining where an event now and an event at some other time are being put together. We'll see what that means. Now, when a current experience gets put together with some of these other joinings, if you will, more complexity is going to arise. The product is what in Indian thought is called samskara. Samskara, or in Pali, samkara. And this is a really important word in the Yoga Sutra and in Indian thought. And again, sam means with, and kara means put together, like karma, for example, or that other word we had before, which I forget now. So samskara, they're all put together. It's usually translated, in our traditions, it's usually called a formation, or fabrication, or a conditioned thing, because here's the catch. Samskara always includes traces of the past, the traces I was talking about, okay? Those traces that often include a component of feeling, of vedana, that carries forward, and maybe some impulse to do something. So sometimes they're even translated, I know Georg Forstein translated as subliminal activators, is that correct? So this idea that these aren't just traces, they're traces with an attitude. I just made that up. Would you make a note of that? I like that. Traces with an attitude. And these are operating in us and giving us attitude. So now let me just, again, trace all of this. And we can think about it for a moment. We talked about how the stream of inputs, it's being coordinated by manas, stimuli from within, without. Okay, it's an enormous stream. And the fact is that we can't actually know all of it, or even very much. Perception studies have shown that we don't have a lot of bandwidth, nearly as much as we think. There's a lot of unconscious scanning that goes on, filtering, extrapolating, to fill in all the blanks. Like when you're looking at me right now, I'm sure you've heard this before, but I'm just repeating stuff that you know, probably. But as you're looking at me now, do you see the blind spots? You know that you have them. In the back of your eye is the retina, but the retina has to connect via the optic nerve to the cortex. So the optic nerve sticks right into the retina at this space called the fundus. So the rods and cones can't be there. All right, particularly the cones, it's in more cone territory. So there's a blind spot there. I'll be damned if I can see it. I'm looking for it right now. Now there's a trick where you look kind of straight ahead and peripherally, you move your hand and the hand disappears, but I've never been able to do that. Can anybody do that? Do you raise your hand if you know how to do that, make your blind spots? So even when I'm trying to overcome this filling in of the mind, I simply cannot do it. Oh, now I've got everybody going like this. Oh, okay. We've got to start filming these Dharma talks so that we can pan the reactions here. So one of the acts of manas is filtering, moving toward mental objects when perceptual objects are actually having gaps in them and so forth. And it's all getting put together in a stew, kind of all thrown together. Uh-huh. But here, when we practice together, when we're in a situation where it's possible, desirable, and we remember the possibility of allowing the mind to settle, all these processes that have been happening to us start to settle. That's been going on here at the retreat to some extent and to previous retreats for all us yogis. In fact, any time we form the intention, it starts to happen and continues to unfold, a kind of a purification, a settling, a clarifying of these processes, which are designed to be a total illusion, so we don't have to think about perceiving. Okay? We form the intention to attend, to be present. I'm not going to get it too much into etymology, but One of the great words in the Buddhist lexicon is a compound word, satipatthana. It's usually translated as the foundation of mindfulness. You know, sati, I'll talk about that a little later. Actually, not too much, but a little. But upatthana has that word in it again that we used in our yoga, ta, standing, ta, ta. Right? Remember that? How pure awareness abides in its very nature? And I mentioned that it was avasthanam. It means just being real still, right here. Just being here. Okay? Upa means near. So upatthana, which is what sati is combined with to make satipatthana, means being mindful, remembering the possibility of being real here, or maybe the reverse. Compounds can go both ways. Maybe it means staying real close to experience in mindfulness. Okay. When we do that, and when we take the controls of our attention, okay, and turn them toward what's happening now, a lot of that mental filling in is no longer required. Okay? So our relationship begins to become a little clearer. And I'm not going to use the image of the muddy water more than a dozen more times, probably. Okay? As we quiet down, we begin to really see what's happening. I use the word see, but it could be here at this moment, for example, if we just listen for a moment. Sounds are arising. In the terms we've been talking about, there's a moment of hearing, a moment of being conscious of sound. This sound. But then this sound. So something very radical. I mean by radical, right at the root of experience, starts to become apparent, which is that one thing happens, and then another. This arises, and that arises. Each moment of consciousness, in fact, is a separate contact, a contact, pasa, contact, an instance where life touches a sense of ours, and thus a consciousness of that sense. For example, light touching the retina, and joining visual consciousness, and voila, there's an instance of seeing. But it's interesting that all of this usually feels continuous, doesn't it? Like usually we think, oh, sound is happening, or sight. A seamless reality is unfolding right now. Why does time feel so omnipresent? If we label each of these contacts just simply ABC, it'll be maybe a little bit easier to discern. Each one of the inputs in the sensory stream happens now. Okay? So A, B, C, and so on. As we've seen, though, most of our experience isn't just the bare forms of sights, sounds, sensations, and so forth. Instead, our everyday experience, especially when we're not meditating, but in our everyday lives and patterns, is almost entirely mental. That seems surprising because we seem to be in a world looking at it, hearing at it, and so forth, and yet we're really in the mental representations about it, the commentary about it, the concepts about it. Okay? All those mental actions I mentioned before, vedana, samnya, and sankara, remember those? They're adding something to the bare experience of just forms, or they're adding to each other, commenting on each other. So an A is put together with a B, or a C, or maybe it's put together with D, E, and F. There's almost no limit to the complexity partly because we're not limited to 26 letters of the alphabet. There's an untold number of things that can be joined, and humans have found a way to join lots of them. But here's the deal. Let's take even the simplest of them, just A, B. It has no counterpart in nature outside of our mind. There's just this, and this, and this. But for most of us, most of the time, it's the compounded things, the things like myself, my views, that seem most real in us, okay? That must be fed, supported, and defended at all costs, too. So, since all A's and B's happen one after another, putting them together cannot help but create a sense of mental or psychological time. It's a little mind bridge from the remembered to the present, or from the present to an imagined future, from past to future. Thus, sanskara always involves time, a kind of a psychological time. The time frame that's involved can be very long. For example, it could be a whole lifespan. When Anna asked us to imagine a beautiful young person becoming old, my beautiful 22-year-old daughter became stooped and feeble and withered. As that happened, a gentle sense of time stretched out before me, kind of like a road, way out ahead of me. And the road led past my grave and on towards hers. And it arose without being summoned, even though I'd made the exercise. I didn't expect that. I knew it was an exercise. I'd created it. I knew the road was kind of a mirage in me and didn't correspond to anything in the actual world. But I felt it, and I feel it now, just thinking about it. Time arises subtly, even when little bare experiences are mentally enjoined, like the sense of liking that might arise after tasting that soup tonight. It creates a little narrative now. I love that soup. That soup was good. So now soup and goodness are not only a couple, but they have a past together. So, here's how Patanjali describes the yoga of this, the yoking toward this phenomenon. Now, beware, there's a little dry language ahead, because it's my translation. But balancing the factors, you won't recognize it, though, because I've changed it a little. It's not exactly like the book. It's probably a little better and worse. But balancing the factors of concentration and focusing on the parade of moments, the word he uses for moments, by the way, kshana, brings insight arising from discrimination. Balancing concentration, focusing on the parade of moments, brings insight from discrimination. And this allows the yogi to tell things apart which had seemed continuous. To tell things apart which had seemed continuous. In this way, discrimination deconstructs, it takes apart all the phenomenal world of objects and conditions. And elsewhere he says, the sense of I am, asmita, is merely an amalgamation, a blurring together of several mind moments, individual moments of consciousness. So consciousness itself isn't even a thing, but a parade of very brief momentary flickers. Consciousness of this, consciousness of that. So we don't even have a consciousness. We're kind of riding along on a stream of little itty-bitty chittas, little momentary chittas. This reminds me of Gulliver being carried along by an army of Lilliputians, you know. To Patanjali, these little instants, kshana, remember I used that word kshana, it's the shortest possible increment of time, you could say. That's how it's thought of. Okay? It's the same word that's used in the later Buddhist text called Abhidhamma. where some of them are concerned with trying to boil down the events of consciousness and to distill them to their ultimate properties. And so the Pali word kana, right, is the same word. Patanjali was probably familiar with some of this teaching, perhaps the Sarvastivada Abhidhamma. I think, though, really, that we can't even call a kshana, the instant here, time, because it's not. It's a moment of contact, and it's happening now, and that's all there is. So calling a momentary contact time is the exact opposite of the truth. It is simply this now. There's never more than now. You've been hearing now for three retreats that the bodily and breath yoga of Patanjali and the Buddha consists of yoking. Yoking to some aspect of the now. As I said earlier, the yogi takes control of manas, takes control of attention, places attention, okay? Turns it to some aspect of the unfolding present. But which aspect? Well, body and breath are very good places to start. Everybody has one, right? It's unfolding now. And its bare experience is form arising. Rupa, as I mentioned before, rupa, elemental feelings. We could break down the body's feelings into these almost irreducible properties of sensation, like the solidity of earth, the thermal energies ranging to fire, the movements of wind and the cohesiveness of water, the binding. But usually we're not able to sense this because we're kind of separate from the body. And we saw this in the yoga classes a little bit. We may think we're feeling the body, but as I suggested to you, when we feel it over time, and anything bodily that seems to last for more than an instant is actually an AB or an ABCDEF. Does that make sense? So we may think we're feeling the body, but we're really feeling a kind of a mental body. So the Buddha actually used a wonderful phrase to try to set the record straight for yogis. He advised the yogis to observe the body in the body. Kaye kayanupasana. Kaye kayanupasana. Okay? And as the yogi trains and develops, makes much of this ability, he or she arrives close enough to bare sensation to be able to tell the difference between the bare sensation and, for example, a feeling of liking or not liking that might immediately arise conditioned upon that sensation. That's why the practice of observing the feeling tone, vedana, liking, not liking, vedana, follows upon getting to know the body in the body. This is my understanding, my experience of this enigmatic phrase. Now, I want to talk a little bit about energy, because it's time to consider how this process really does happen. I mean, how do we get close to experience, if you think about it? After all, these sanskaras, these conditioned senses, oh, I like this soup, so this soup, you know, I'm not going to have it. That hurts, so I won't do that again. We're getting pulled away from our experience and really set in past and future. Well, as I've said, the intention is a critical element, the intention. And to have that intention, we have to remember that it's a good thing. So this is all very important, and sati means remembering. But there's another important reason, another way that enables us, I should say another circumstance in all this that allows us to get close to experience again and again and again. Whatever pulled us away, whatever pattern of affliction, like for instance the cough in the throat, which I'll have a drink about. Whatever contraction that we find ourselves caught up in, whatever we've been ensnared in, whatever identity arises for a moment or a month, excuse me, whatever we're talking about, it's a conditioned thing. It's an A, B, C, D, E, F. It's a complexity. It's contracting in on us. But it's taken a lot of energy to create it. And all conditioned things, all sanskara or sankara, all of them pass away. So each time we catch some part of ourself contracting, its grip on us is actually starting to loosen in some way. Okay? William Blake observed, one thought fills immensity. The space of awareness, entirely filled, this vast, limitless space. One thought fills it. But that thought can't keep filling it. Blake didn't say that. That's my commentary on it. I don't think he said it. Okay. In our meditation on the breath, for example, sometimes the breath is the last thing on our mind. We're caught up in thoughts. We're thinking about this. Okay, how do you know? How do you know that you were thinking? Because at some point, you aren't thinking that thought anymore. Whatever that thought was that arose, it passed away. It weakened, it decayed. All things that require energy do. And this is a natural law. What goes up must come down. So maybe the fantasy had us fooled for a moment. We weren't conscious enough to prevent it from blooming, right? Because it just doesn't start out full bore. So we weren't conscious enough to catch it. But it weakened. And then there it is. Last June, July, I mentioned that the image of the muddy water was very interesting to me, although I don't use muddy water anymore. I use miso. Miso soup is much better. It's a lot faster than muddy water. When the waiter or waitress brings the miso soup to the table, it's completely clouded over because they've been carrying it along, you know, and jiggling on the tray. So they set it down on the table, and that's agitating too. So it's just pure muddy froth. You're about to take a little spoonful of it, and then somebody says something, and you talk to them for a moment. And when you look down again, already it's starting to clarify. You're already seeing these clouds of the miso stuff kind of descending, settling downward. As we pointed out in my talk in June, this is a real property of growing clarity, which is that for the first time we notice how many clouds there are. We really notice affliction. We can start to see it more and more as we clarify. So, as my friend Larry Rosenberg says, self-knowledge is bad news. But it's a sign that we're actually starting to see things and that the natural gravity, the entropy, really, of the situation is manifesting. Okay. By the way, we also notice this a lot in our Hatha Yoga. In our Hatha Yoga, we pointed to how sometimes what felt like a solid body actually turns out to be something we were doing that we didn't know we were doing. Some contraction, like in the hip joint, it's all clenched. And you think, oh, that's just this really solid hip joint. But after a minute or two, or three, or four, suddenly he says, oh, I can release that. Something's changing. Oh, I can just let go there. Well, what's changing is that we're coming closer to it usually, settling into it. That's why so many of the movements that we did were set up to last for three or four or five minute so things could settle a little, so we could suddenly become aware of this little bodily cloud in us, the contraction, and continue to allow it to settle and not just get it stirred up again. I'd like to tell you about what may have been my first Dharma teacher. I'm going back in time now to about the age of 10 or so. When I was a kid that age, my family would all sit together on Sunday nights and watch television. It's kind of like the opening of The Simpsons, you know, where they all somehow kind of descend on the couch. Only this was a long time before The Simpsons. What we watched was a show called The Ed Sullivan Show. Some of you remember it, I'm sure. It was a variety show with comedians, singers, and dancers. It was kind of like, actually, an old-fashioned burlesque show, really. Although, you know, as a 10-year-old, I missed the strippers. But if you were around back then, you probably remember the Ed Sullivan Show because it had the greatest acts on television. For example, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and stuff. This left a big impression on me. But there's another act that left just as big an impression for some reason as those others, probably. And I'm surprised by this because it was a juggler. And he was very meek. He'd come out on stage almost as if by surprise. The stage was set up with five or six poles, and they were set up around a table with six plates on it, right? Okay. And he'd pick them up, and then somebody took the table away. And he'd take the first plate, and he'd put it atop pole number one and kind of give it a tentative spin, and it would wobble a little, and he'd spin it a little bit more, and he'd kind of lighten up, you know, his expression as he spun it a little bit more and a little bit more. That was great. So then he'd take another plate and he'd put that on number two, and then a number three, and number four. But while he's turning toward three and four, one is starting to wobble, and he's looking away, and you could hear the audience, and also my family, which are all sitting together, go, you know, it's starting to wobble. It's going to fall off the pole, because, you know, it's spinning, and if it stops spinning, it's going to fall off the pole and crash, and you know, and that would be a calamity if it crashed. Mm-hmm. By the way, while this is going on, the band is striking up some crazy music. It's the music that you've heard it. It goes like this. It goes da la da 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 da. So now we're all becoming frantic with him, because he hears the intake of breath and he turns toward the first plates and realizes they're wobbling, and he rushes over frantically and spins them again like this. But they get going, and then he has to do three and four and one, and then he's kind of got one and two and three and four, he's kind of got them. So now he takes five and he puts that up, and then six. But now three and four are going, and then one, and all of a sudden he's put up too many. He's put up six, okay? It's kind of like the six senses, isn't it? He's put up six, and he's going from one to the other, and he's doing them all really, really fast, frantically, like this. And all of a sudden, he just stops. He stops. And the plates are spinning at various velocities, and beginning to acquire more and more wobble. And he, as I remember it, and your memory might be different than mine, he just got very still all of a sudden, like a cat, confident. And as one weakened and another, he could kind of hear it and sense it. And as it finally fell off the pole, he would leap like a cat and grab it and then come back to the center. And then somehow sense the next one. And I mean, there are five. Which one's going to fall? He knew. And it would fall, and he'd get that one. And then this one. And then that one. And that. And that. Well, my goodness. Can you imagine all this? See, we don't need TV on a meditation retreat. We have our minds, you know? So finally, he had all the plates safely tucked under his arm. Okay, and with his other arm, He saluted the audience boldly. You know, they're now on their feet, applauding, screaming, in ecstasy. And he began to head off the stage. But before he got to the wings, he turned to the audience with a smile, and then suddenly and violently flung one of the plates straight down onto the floor. And I remember a jolt went through me like an electric shock. But the plate didn't break. It just bounced right up, and he caught it with a flourish, turned, smiled, and winked at us. Thank you very much. You know, I think I'm coming to the end of this talk now. And by the way, this is exactly on time, too. Yeah, isn't it? I remembered that I promised to let you know how my own house building went. Well, it was very, very hard. I was not a very good worker. But shoddy, though the foundation looked to me, my boss said it was adequate. So on top of it, we built a frame. and also most of the house. And that was in the summer of 1972. I heard later that fall that my boss's parents did move in, and then that was the end of it. I didn't hear any more about them. Okay. I wonder. Anyway, about 30 years later, I happened to visit the vineyard again with my kids, and at one point we found ourselves in the neighborhood doing something else. But I mentioned to them that I had helped to build a house nearby, and they decided we absolutely had to check it out. I don't think they believed it. I was secretly delighted. I didn't protest too much because I didn't want to bore them with my stories of when I was a youth and so forth, but I really wanted to see it for myself. You know, I had walked down that road every day for the whole summer, okay? But I just couldn't find it, all right? I was on the right road. I was on the right block. But I became confused. I got disoriented. And then I realized we were standing right in front of it. The house was no longer there. There were trees and lawn. So I guess he didn't own it anymore. Okay? But all the labor, all the materials, the finished product, all had vanished without a trace. Yeah, such is the nature of all compound things. Let's sit for a moment. Gaha karaka ditasi punageham nakahasi sabate pasuka bhaga gahakurtam visankitam visankaragatam chitantananam kayam ajaga. House builder, now that you've been cleansed, you shall not raise this house again. Your rafters all are broken, your ridge pole shattered. The mind is free of fabricated things. Don't come to the end of craving.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.